I mean, my story goes all the way back to, when I was growing up. I remember my mother had student debt herself from her master's degree. My dad, who's from Europe, went through the British school system, and he actually didn't have any debt. So I think just as a kid, I was hyper aware that there was something to do with nationality and debt. I didn't really understand why or how, but as I got older, I started to realize, different countries do education differently, and it leads to very different results. And so I think I was already kind of predisposed to being mindful of those different experiences, comparing and contrasting, and seeing how debt impacted my mom's career and her life decisions, and how my dad kind of got sucked into that.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Use Case. You got me laughing already. If you're watching, William's waving at me. If you're listening, I just sound like a goofball. But my name's Ryan Leary. I am here today with William Tinkencup, of course. William, how are you today?
Great. Wonderful.
Sounding a little sick today.
Good.
Yeah, a little sick. And our guest today is Will Searley from Summer. So, Will, why don't you kick us off? Introduce yourself to the audience and give us a little background on Searley.
Awesome.
I'm sorry, on Summer. Good Lord.
All good.
Summer.
All good. It's alliterative, so we can kind of jump back and forth. But Ryan and William, it's awesome to be here. Super excited to chat with you today. So just by way of background, I'm the founder and CEO of Summer, and I've been in the student loan space, first on the policy side, then in the innovation side for the last 15 years. It's something I'm super passionate about. It's a generational challenge, but it affects all generations in various ways. And I think it's one of the biggest challenges that our country has really struggled to solve. So I'm fired up to work on it each and every day to try to make it a better situation for millions of folks.
So how did you get into this? What, I mean, obviously on the policy side, but how did you start?
Yeah. I mean, my story goes all the way back to, when I was growing up. I remember my mother had student debt herself from her master's degree. My dad, who's from Europe, went through the British school system, and he actually didn't have any debt. So I think just as a kid, I was hyper aware that there was something to do with nationality and debt. I didn't really understand why or how, but as I got older, I started to realize, different countries do education differently, and it leads to very different results. And so I think I was already kind of predisposed to being mindful of those different experiences, comparing and contrasting, and seeing how debt impacted my mom's career and her life decisions, and how my dad kind of got sucked into that, but was, literally foreign to it, and had to kind of learn how to navigate that. And then as I was going through college, I was just hyper aware of student debt and the cost of college. I went to a public university, a great one, but did so even though I got into other private colleges because I wanted to keep the sticker price down. I wanted to take on less debt. And then when I graduated in 2008, 2009, and saw just the financial crisis then,
oh my God,
wrecking the country, kind of wreaking havoc on the job market at the time. I was just so hyper aware of, like, we had all taken on student debt to have this promise of a higher ed degree that could open up career opportunities and doors to us. And yet it felt like that door was being closed before we even started the race, as the job market dried up. And it forced me to ask some really tough questions. Like, why is this the system? Like, why are we talking about bailing out banks when people have taken on 50, 60, 80, 100K of debt and they're not getting bailed out?
Right.
But they have to deliver on this without actually necessarily having a clear path to a job. Even though that was kind of the promise of what a college degree generally offers. And so I think I just, was already teed up for being interested in it, and then just directly impacted by it, and poured my, the next 15 years from then till now into trying to figure out how to fix it.
So we're going to spend time today going through the program and exactly what you're offering. We're going to ask a lot of questions, but kick us off with a little bit about Summer. What is it?
Yep. Sure. Summer's been around now for 6 years, and we've helped over 200,000 individuals navigate student loan repayment, successfully finding saving solutions for them, cumulatively generating $1.6 billion in savings and counting. We do this primarily by looking at the problem both sort of preventatively, helping parents navigate college costs on the front end to find lower cost programs that provide success outcomes for their children, planning for how to save for college on the front end, thinking through where they can find cheaper options, even through just scholarships and other initiatives. And then for those that have the debt themselves, we're enrolling them in a whole array of government loan assistance programs, making sure they're really set up for success. So that part of the offering that we provide is sort of similar to how an accountant will work with you on your taxes. There are all these different ways that people could reduce their tax burden. Oftentimes, it's super confusing which, you know, credit or which program you qualify for based on a whole array of stipulations, and you really rely on an accountant or tax software to guide you through to optimize your tax payments to reduce that burden as best as possible. So student loans, very correlated in that average borrower has over a dozen different types of loans. They might be paying loans to over two, three, sometimes as many as four different financial institutions. Some are government, some are private student loans. Some are variable interest rates, fixed interest rates. And unlike a mortgage where people really generally have just one loan, they know who they're paying, they know the amount, and it's oftentimes a source of pride that they have a mortgage. It's a milestone. Student debt for most people is something that's a stressor. It's hard to keep track of. It's something you don't necessarily know your payments off the top of your head. You know they're a lot, but you know, it's multiple and they change. So we try to provide a constant source of support, navigating people through that process so they can track it all in one place. They can reduce that stress of this unknown, you know, what's the gotcha? What's the thing that's going to get me? We give them clear guidance and use technology to provide them a dashboard and recommendations where they can save along the way. And so we do that start to finish. And we're only growing. The student loans have just come due as of October for 44 million people. And those payments are due again after 3.5 years that were paused during the pandemic. So people had a bit of a reprieve that is no longer in effect. So now they have to start paying. And there are millions of people who are paying for the first time ever right now, just in their first few months, and they're very stressed about it. So we really provide this helping hand and navigation through that process.
Do you work with employers in HR as a benefit?
Yes. So along the way, we built this incredible product to help the individual navigate this process. And it actually surprised us how many employers started coming to us saying, we've been talking about our 401k for decades, and it's been our big competitive advantage. We have this great match. And we're seeing that all these people are coming out of college with debt. And now the statistic is close to 3 in 4 people are graduating with over $40,000 of debt. And they're telling us they don't understand why we're talking about a 401k, which is only going to help them in their eyes in 40 or 50 years. But they've got $80,000, $100,000 of debt hanging over their head right now that's preventing them from moving out of home from their parents. You know, people are like, millennials, Gen Z, they just love living at home. It's like, well, maybe they don't actually like it as much as you think. Maybe they
can't
actually
get out.
They can't get out. There's this handcuff element of, like, you know, the bills are too expensive. It is hard to square rent, student debt, you know, and all these other cost of living going up across the board, inflation. It's a difficult time to be a young person and navigate all of that. And it's just different from how it was, you know, decades ago. I meet constantly folks who in their 40s, 50s, 60s, say, well, I paid $10,000 for college, $5,000. And I was like, that's awesome.
I was just going to ask you that question. I literally was just going to say, well, wait a minute here. I mean, like, I didn't have that benefit, right? And I didn't pay a lot. I paid $300 and some a month for 10 years. So, I mean, it's a lot, but it wasn't $800 a month for $250,000, right? So
But the, with the inflation, cost of inflation, wasn't it simple? I mean, wasn't it similar?
Yeah, so inflation went up, but college costs actually greatly exceeded inflation.
Yeah.
And that's the main driver of the debt.
Yeah. So Will, let's look at it as if I'm an employer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now obviously I want to offer benefits, which mm-hmm. as an employer I probably offer traditional benefits, like you said, the investment plans and all the other stuff that's available.
Sure.
Where do you come in? Where does Summer come in, and how am I selling this? What am I offering to my employees?
Yeah, so we really offer this as a holistic benefit that can help a myriad of employees. I think a lot of employers come to us by saying, you know, this is a recruiting initiative, and we get it. Like you're thinking about young people coming out of college, you want to speak to their immediate needs. But I think what people actually don't realize is that the fastest growing group of student loan borrowers are people over the age of 50. This affects people of all generations. And the reason for it is a lot of folks in that category are taking on debt in their own name for their children who are going to college, or even their grandchildren.
So they're not. So they're not actually going back to school.
Some of them are. But the main driver, not that guy, not this guy. But you can, and you know we actually help with that too. I'll get to this in a second. But we do tuition reimbursement for employers that want to upskill their employees help them gain new skills and new credentials to take on new types of work so they can keep progressing on the job and increase the retention rate of their employees over time. Parking that on the side, we can come back to answer your original question. On average, we see employers have 30 to 40% of employees that have student debt. Some employers, like hospitals, universities, their own employees required to have secondary degree, post-secondary degrees, master's, PhDs. And those employers have upwards of 60%, sometimes even as high as 80 that have student debt. And that's also true of like K-12 school systems, where you have to have a master's degree to teach. So the debt is pretty rampant in those employers. But when we're working with your average employer, private sector, we oftentimes see 30 to 40%. But if you ask the question, are you contributing to a student loan in your family? That number jumps from 30 to 40% who have a loan in their name to actually closer to 50 to 60% who are contributing to a loan in their family. And that might be for their children. If you add in all of the parents who have college-bound children ranging from birth all the way through the age of 18, you'll see that it adds on average another 20% of the workforce that have children that are college bound, and the parents are starting to think, or very actively thinking, how do I deal with what could be the biggest expense in my life, second to a mortgage, and for those that aren't homeowners, the biggest expense in their life. And so when you add all of that up, the average employer has about 80% of employees that have been impacted or will be impacted by college costs in a meaningful way as one of their biggest financial expenses. Right. So employers are starting to reframe how they think about their role around financial wellness. It used to be, well, we're going to pay you, so that's financial wellness. You get a salary. And you should also be excited that we're going to help you with retirement so you can have that. Now let's talk about health. Let's talk about healthcare. And that's where we're going to focus a lot of our benefits. But we're seeing over the last few years, just the changing demographics of our country. Americans have more debt than any other country on the planet. And Americans today have more debt than any generation prior. And so when you look at that changing nature of what it means to be an American today, you just have different demographics. You have different characteristics than any other generation before. So yesterday's benefits don't work for today's workforce. And what that means is employers are now thankfully starting to ask the right questions, which is, how do we better serve this population? And let's look under the hood. It's not just broad general financial wellness. There's actually a lot of research that shows that when you just teach people financial literacy, it's not enough.
Right.
you know, it's mm-hmm. it really is like if you're trying to teach someone how to swim and all you're telling them is like, you know, you're teaching them outside of the pool. You're telling them verbally, here's how water exists. Here's how you need to move your limbs in the water. It's too conceptual. People are sinking right now because there are real things happening. And to use an analogy, student debt for them is like a weight at their feet. You know, it's pulling them down. Mm-hmm. And so if you're trying to conceptually teach them about savings and other things, and that's not to say that you shouldn't do it, it's usually not enough. People are, you know, learning about that information and yet they're still sinking. And so we are going to employers and say, we have tangible solutions that actually unlock tens of thousands of dollars for your employees. We're saving employees an average of $40,000 per employee by going in and getting employees to either significantly reduce college costs on the front end and or enroll them in loan assistance programs today that they didn't know about, or if they knew about, were struggling to enroll in, and helping them to do it successfully. So we're all about how high impact, actionable solutions to give those employers the ability to say to their workforce, whether you have debt today, you're worried about taking it on tomorrow, we have a solution that customizes to your unique needs that will give you those results. And the way that we tell every employer we're worth the bet is we offer a savings guarantee for every employer that we work with a money back guarantee to that employer. So we are so confident about the impact we can create, the employer, can take a bet on us and know that they're going to, we're going to put our money where our mouth is on that.
So what, when you said a few minutes ago, you said, you know, when you go to college, it's kind of implied that there'll be a job waiting for you on the other side of this, right? So first of all, let's attack that. What if that wasn't true? Because I think for generations that was true. And I think we did either say it or it was either stated or it was implied. Go through school. It's going to be hard. Get to the other side of it. Get a degree. And there'll be something waiting for you, a job, some type of economic situation. And I think there's been generations. Really, I think it's really whenever there's been a market collapse, the people that come out around that market collapse, you know, 91 was a housing crisis, 2000 was a market collapse, 2001 was 9/11. So people, if you were to talk to people that graduated in those years, you'd find the same stressors that you see that when you graduated in 08, which was like the worst time to graduate ever. But I'm thinking about like,
way to rub it in, William. I'm just teasing.
It was really the worst. It was, technically. Yeah.
There's a lot of millennial resentment around that.
100%. Yeah. 100%. I mean, and it's fair. Like, I get it. But like, should we say college there? Should we tell? Because Ryan's got three daughters. I've got two sons. Some of which they're going to go into college. Should we tell them, hey, when you get to the end of this, there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee that there is a job. There's just no guarantees at all.
Yeah.
Like, what should we do as parents?
So I think it's a great question. I think first off, it's important to clarify, and I think this is something I've actually been talking about now for over a decade, is the ROI, the return on investment of a college degree, net-net, is still higher than those that do not go to college.
I saw that. I saw that recently.
25% or so, it said. Yeah.
Yeah. So what that essentially means in plain English is, if you were to just look at your earning potential, how much money you could earn over the course of your career with a college degree, subtract the cost of college, and compare that to your earning potential as a high school graduate without the cost of college, it is still more favorable just based economics to go to college than not. So if I was a parent, you know, trying to help guide my child through that, I would put that information in front of them and just say, like, look, I know college, there's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of reasons why people might not go to college, and we can talk about that. But just net net, you will make more money in your life if you go to college than if you don't. Now, obviously, everything is more, you know, devil's in the details. What degree are you getting?
Right.
And so, you know, how are you thinking about that degree? You know, is there a job market on the other side of that specialty concentration? And so I have a lot of friends in college who were English majors, and they repeatedly have joked since college about being an English major and how hard it is to find a job with an English major now. That said, some of my highest paid friends are also those who were complaining that there were no jobs for them as English majors. And some of them went on to go work in McKinsey consulting, and they now, you know, are bank executives. And I'm like, okay, stop complaining. Like, you figured it out.
There's no more of that.
So I tell that anecdote solely to say, like, I think parents feel this immense need to, like, guide their children through the, like, not just where you go to college, but what you study, and really thinking about what comes after. And I think that that's important. And, you know, but I will just say, and this is just speaking anecdotally, what you study is rarely the thing you end up doing later. And just because you're going into something with technically traditionally fewer job prospects on the other end doesn't necessarily mean you won't figure it out along the way and find an option. But, you know, there are more risks. You're taking on more risk if you go into a major that has fewer job prospects on the other end. And so I think that conversation needs to happen. You know, I'm not here to tell people how to parent. But I think it's always good to put the information in front of your kids and help them think about it as they go through that process. Because at least when I was going through college, I don't think it was even talked about, really. Like, you know, hey, how are you going to, you know, make money after college? How are you going to pay off your debt? It wasn't really part of the university college experience. Like, maybe my mom brought it up, but I, you know, it's just mom, you know, it wasn't anyone else. And so
I didn't really have a choice. It was, you're going to college, and that was it.
Sorry.
Exactly.
What was, you know, the difficulty that I have is like sociologies. You know, we don't make enough sociologists to deal with the demand of sociologists in our society and all the different problems that they help rectify. Yet we don't pay sociologists.
Sure.
So someone goes through, even if they go through, a great local program or whatever, they're still going to create a bunch of debt.
Right.
If they can't pay for it, they're going to be burdened with a low salary because we don't pay sociologists. We need them. And then it's a burden that they're going to be dragging around forever. Like, right. I mean, 30 years for some people, they're just, I can see that being overwhelming for people that have a desire to dig a degree to help society, not just help themselves. Like, you know, like if you're getting a degree in finance, you know, okay, fair enough. Like, that's a little bit different. But if you're getting a degree in sociology, you're trying to help people. Do you see government in any way kind of participating in this and augmenting how people choose degrees? Like, and what I'm thinking about is just this. We need humanities majors. We need people that do study things like philosophy, etc. Maybe the job prospects aren't as dot to dot like a degree in accounting, but we need these people. Like, do you see the government? Do you see them playing a role and helping people, if you even offset the cost or something like that?
Yeah, I, William, it's a great question, and I'll say it's a nuanced answer, but I would say there's a lot of different ways to look at it. The first things first is you can answer it through the lens of, like, what's the role of the university? What's the role of the parent? What's the role of the government? Generally speaking, what's the role of society? And each of those may have different answers. I will call out, just to use this story I told earlier, my dad grew up going to King's College London, and then he went to the University of Cambridge in the UK. I was just watching Oppenheimer, and I saw Oppenheimer studied there. I was like, oh, all right. But inevitably, in those programs in the UK, and this is predominantly true around much of Europe, there's a much bigger burden placed on specialization at a younger age. there's a theory about how do you help the student figure out what they're good at and what is the specialty track to really focus on. So that system really focuses on specialization. And so they were like, my dad was good at math. They were like, but we don't need as many mathematicians, but we need more scientists because science is sort of applied math. So you're going to be a scientist. And, you know, he became a physical chemist at the age of 26. He had a PhD in physical chemistry. He met my mom, who is one of the first students to get into Cambridge as a woman in the 80s. She was a transfer student from Columbia, where she was earning her master's in, I believe it was history at the time. So she art history, then she transferred into history. She was writing a dissertation on sort of like the lost literature of World War II and World War I, and, you know, the guys who went to the trenches and were going to write the next great novel, but only got halfway, so to speak. So she went to Cambridge to work on her dissertation. She met my dad. He was amazed when he met this American, just how her education experience was like choose your own adventure, liberal arts. It was like explore your true self. Like, yeah. It, you know, there's no failure. And he kind of had this wake up moment at the age of 26, like 25, I guess, when he's still in the program, where he's like, what am I doing? Like, I don't even like this topic. But he just was kind of pushed through it, and he was good at it. And so the system pushed him through. And so the interesting takeaway I got from that, and I still talk about this with my parents, is just America has this liberal arts philosophy in academia that you should choose what you want to choose, and there is no failure, and every topic is on the table and should be. And that is actually best for education and learning and freedom of thought and expression. In Europe, it's very different, right? It's this track. He ended up pivoting, decided he didn't want to be a scientist, and then interestingly leveraged the fact that he was using early computing with access to like literally punch card computing in the early 80s in the lab with the top technology at Cambridge, that he got a job in New York working doing technology for large institutions that needed help figuring out tech, and it just paid a lot more. Mm-hmm. You know, he found his way, she found her way. Ironically, she went into, you know, real estate and is, you know, doing residential real estate, totally different than what either of them studied. One system was focused on specialization, one was focused on choose your own adventure, and both of them ended up in totally different career paths, regardless of the education system. So I'd say, you know, both systems have pros and cons. There are people who've become world-class scientists, technologists that came through the UK or the European system and were rewarded by specializing early and accelerating that much faster. In the United States, I can at least speak anecdotally among my peers. There's a lot of people who, like my mom, like my peers, even myself, are kind of just wandering through careers being like, wow, this has nothing to do with what I studied. But I don't necessarily regret having studied something that isn't immediately corollary. But I probably could have benefited by having a little bit more focus provided through the university system, nonetheless. So, you know, I think with respect to the government, I do think that the government can at least play a role in terms of supporting industries. For example, social workers, you were mentioning sociology earlier, but social workers, like, very important role in society, very, 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 very important role, just totally underpaid, really underpaid. And I have a friend, really good friend of mine from high school, who went and became a social worker. She was working in New York City, seeing people who really needed help, doing incredible work day in and day out. She had all this student debt from her social work degree. And I kid you not, in order to pay it off, she did the calculation. It would take her like 30 years, something crazy. So she decided in that moment to become a doctor, because doctors get paid a lot more. And so she took on something like another $200,000 of debt in this ROI analysis to be like, in order to pay off my 80K of social worker debt, I can be paid 4 to 5 times more. And I will, weirdly enough, pay off this debt if I, you know, become a doctor, have that higher earning potential. And she just finished her residency now, like 6 years, something like that, after finishing that decision, that calculation. And she's just come to me for student loan help. And it's a scary time for her because she's not earning that salary yet. Mm-hmm. She has more debt than ever before. But these are like real life decisions people are making,
yeah.
Where, you know, they're trying to figure out how to navigate, you know, salary, debt level, you know, the cost of the degree. These numbers keep changing. And how do you build a life around that? And it's really difficult. It's a really hard thing to navigate.
So Will, I get a question for you. I want to go back to the employer side and what they're offering. How, as an employer, how do they know they need something? I mean, they know their employees have issues, right? They know they have challenges with this, but how do they know they need this solution? What's the trigger?
It's a great question
for
Ryan.
Them.
So we see this come in a variety of different ways. So an immediate example is, you know, I was talking to a hospital recently that is a nonprofit hospital. And there is a program called Public Service Loan Forgiveness. It's one of the best initiatives that helps people wipe out their debt after 10 years of working for a nonprofit or government employer. It was created in 2007 as an effort to get people to work in the public sector, work for nonprofits, doing similar, William, what we were just talking about.
Right.
How do you get people to work in these important jobs where they're just naturally paid less than the private sector, but still require college degrees and sometimes master's degrees to do them, where the debt level can be unbearable? Now, over the last few years, the Biden administration has expanded the access to this program. It used to be that 98% of applicants were flat out rejected. I think it was actually close to 99%. We used to say it was easier to get into Harvard than to get public service loan forgiveness. So even though it existed, people didn't trust it. People didn't believe it because there were all these sort of horror stories of folks who were applying and not getting this program. Employers are required to fill out the verification form for employees to get this loan forgiveness. Why? Because the employee can't just say, well, I work for a nonprofit, forgive my debt. They need to prove it. And so the employer has to fill out this form with the FEIN number, the EIN number, and a manager has to approve. It can be audited. And it's a compliance issue for any employer. So what we have seen is employers are increasingly realizing they need administrative support. This is a benefit to the HR team, like an administrative support function. They also realize their employees are significantly benefiting from this. And while we're saving borrowers $40,000 on average, which is generally across the spectrum, those who benefit from public service loan forgiveness are saving closer to $80,000. It is really an incredible program. And in so far, there's 12 million people who qualify, but fewer, around a million, but fewer than a million have actually applied. So the disconnect there is great program, can help a lot of people, it can cancel a lot of debt. Not enough people who are eligible are applying. Those who apply are still struggling to navigate the paperwork and the programs required to get that debt canceled. And we come in and we help with all of that. So we, like an employer may come to us being like, we have these forms, we're seeing employees need help. We're not experts on student loans. We don't want to be. We're likely to get it wrong. These programs are so confusing. It's like, they're like, we don't, there's a reason we don't do our employees' taxes.
Hold on. Hard stop. They're confusing for a reason.
Yeah.
They could be simple.
Yeah.
And this is a little jaded.
I hear you. I hear you. I will say, whether you think they're confusing intentionally because of malintent, or whether you think they're confusing because they're just the person who designed them wasn't exactly thinking about who's going do this.
I think it's
more the latter. You may think it's the former, but the result is still the same. They're really darn confusing.
Good point.
I love how he played the middle line there.
He did. Yeah. It was very nice.
You make him a good politician.
I worked in D.C. for 6 years in student loan policy.
There we go.
When I was in the government, I always was like, why are these systems so poorly created?
I just don't understand.
And I watched House of Cards and all the conspiracy TV shows. And I was like, maybe it was malintent. Maybe it was like actually scripted this way to keep people you know, struggling through. And I,
here's an 18-year-old. Let's give him a document that's 60 pages.
Right.
It says a bunch of things.
Right.
So conspiracy is way more interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's more fun, for sure. Again, having a lawyer present with an 18-year-old being able to go to a document and say, yeah, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
That would, that alone would
I'm
be
glad
helpful.
We're talking about this because this is actually why I started Summer. Like, this is the reason. You asked me earlier, like, what got me into this. I told you that story. This is why I did start the company.
Right.
I realized when I was in DC that there are all these factors that have created the mess of our broken student loan system.
Right.
And there are, yeah, you can go down the whole line of like, it's very interesting that Joe Biden had, you know, spent an early part of his career not being a friend to student loan borrowers. The reason why student debt is extremely hard to get rid of in bankruptcy is in part Biden, when he was senator, actually voted for that and made it harder to get rid of your student debt in bankruptcy when student lenders lobbied to say, well, you can take away a car from an auto loan holder, you can take away a house and foreclose, but you can't take someone's education, so we need more protections on a student loan. And Biden was not a friend to borrowers. He sided with the lender. And if you look where Sallie Mae is headquartered, just so happens to be in the state of Delaware. So there are a lot of folks. So I might be feeding William and Ryan.
See where we're going.
Yeah.
Although, Will, I do want to get your take on something similar but different. But a lot of boomers, I would say, get triggered by the forgiveness word. Mm-hmm. And because they hear forgiveness and they think to themselves, well, there was nobody forgiving the stuff that I went through. Okay, whatever. Who cares? There's really not forgiveness. It's not like the loan's taken a hit.
Right.
They're not writing off the debt.
Right.
The government's giving them a subsidy.
Right.
And we give subsidies to everyone. I mean, not to everyone, but in the Midwest, we have people that grow corn because we give them a subsidy to grow corn because we need corn.
Yep.
Ethanol, right? So, like, what's the difference? Like, why are people misunderstanding that it's just a subsidy and we do subsidy? We're in the business. Yep. The federal government, of course. Yeah. We're in the business of subsidies.
Right.
I don't think
many people realize that, though. They
really?
Just look at corn growers and farmers and say, they're fantastic
growing
people. They're growing corn. They don't realize the business side to that. I never looked at it that way.
This is until I knew about it. This is a super, super political topic, and any political topic, there's so much misinformation.
Bill, if you don't stop it.
I know. But what happens in any political topic is you get one fact, and then it's morphed and it's modified, mm-hmm. And there's a lot of information that's not discussed that kind of can help you come out with a fair and more balanced opinion. So let me just say this. I think whenever someone hears that they went through something hard and the next generation or some other group of people gets something better, they think it's unfair. And that is innate human instinct. It's animal instinct. It's been going on for thousands of years. I think the biggest mistake of the Democratic Party for the solutions they've been working on was they did not talk about this in the way that every parent knows that when your first child doesn't get a car bought for them and has to earn their way to buy a car, and their youngest child asks for a car, if you give them a car, you're going to create havoc in your family. It'll be seen as...
That'll be forever, too, by the way.
It'll never end. That grudge is going to the grave. So
100%.
I think in many ways, the biggest mistake of the Democratic Party was that they didn't think like a parent with children who one child asked for something, didn't get it, and they're trying to do it for the other. Now, the reality is people who paid for college 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago just paid less. They just paid less. Statistically, you can look at the numbers. It was significantly less. And so anyone who says, well, I paid for my college, it's like, sure, we're looking at actually apples to oranges on that more than you realize. The second point I'd make is with respect to why, I think it's worth calling out before 2008 and the financial crisis we referred to earlier.
Your graduation.
Many states use like subsidized college education.
Right.
Just huge portions of the state budget would go, and it, yes, for state schools, but that's the majority of colleges in America.
Right.
We always talk about the Ivy Leagues, like they're everywhere. There's like eight of them. There's 4,000 colleges, and most of them are state funded. But those budgets got significantly slashed when the economy cratered, and those state budgets were caught up in a lot of these financial instruments, and they woke up to a half-sized budget in many cases. And guess whose budget got cut next? The university's budget.
Sure.
And what did the university do? They pushed the cost to the family. And so if you look at the cost of college, that, among many other factors, has led to this huge burden taken on by anyone who graduated after 2007, 2008, 2009. And that was already on a trend that didn't look good. You know, those tuitions
just
going
sped
up.
It
just was a catalyst. It just like blew the lid off of it. And so again, I think that is a huge part of this. The other thing I'll say, even if I haven't won you over to maybe thinking differently on this topic, for those listening who are still like,
we're buying, don't worry, we'll buy.
He might make a point there, but I still think this is ridiculous. Anyway, I do think the other thing to say is what Biden should have said, in what any of the Democrats pushing this should have said, is we need to control the cost of college and look at people who have been struggling.
Right.
And we need, instead of this blanketed effort, we need to be thoughtful about who is struggling, why, and how to help them, and define that population so that it's undeniable that they're struggling and we need to help them. And then we need to think about how to get the cost of college under control. And it's not a first, second, it's not a this, now, that, then. It's, we got to do it at the same time, because as a parent, if you're giving Joe a car and Sally doesn't get a car, what is Sally getting so that she's not taking that grudge to the grave? You got to look at it as, I'm going to give you this and I'm going to give you that and I'm going to acknowledge. And the reality is that analogy doesn't even quite hold up, because in this conversation, it's about future kids. And so, you know, it's really about, you know, creating a sense of fairness. It's like, you might not go back to everyone who's gone to college and say, like, look, you're going to get a tax break too, but you at least can say, we're not going to do these rolling debt jubilees every five to 10 years as the cost just skyrockets so that it, like, people don't even think they should pay their loans back, because they're just going to get their debt wiped out every 5 to 10 years, which creates a perverse incentive. So the way you keep everyone calm is you say, we're going to focus on the people who really need help, and here's how we're defining those people. It's not just everyone gets $10,000.
Right.
You know, it's something different. It's people of this characteristic. And then you say, we got to get the cost of college under control. We got to get these schools to have more skin in the game. If these students are not graduating, or they're graduating with debt and they're not finding jobs, they need to be held accountable.
Agreed.
And if they 100%. Had skin in the game, that would go a long way to keeping college costs from continuing to grow exponentially.
Drops Mike, walks off stage.
All right, guys, I got to go. No, I'm just saying, I'm still here.
Will, seriously, this has been, we could talk for another hour. You're just an amazing person. You built an amazing company. Thank you so much for coming on the show.